I was amused when I started reading your book, Mr. President, how in the beginning, unlike the history we might learn in schools, that once the Constitution of the United States was signed, the government was far from organized and took some great efforts to really come to the behemoth that we see today.
It did indeed. The Constitution created a figurehead as president. The framers had lived under the tyranny of England's King George III for many, many years, and we're not about to seat another King George IV on the presidential seat in America. So they created a figurehead. Unfortunately, they couldn't foresee the crises that George Washington would face as the first president of the United States. At one point, mobs ran riot in the temporary capital of Philadelphia and threatened to drag Washington out of his house and onto the gallows. There were revolutions all over the country, rioting. The country was out of control. And Congress at the time only met for 6 weeks, two sessions of 6 weeks each in the spring and in the fall. They were out of session most of the year, and far from the Capitol. There were no highways or mechanized transportation in those days. They had to travel by horseback and carriage over often impassable roads. So there was Washington alone to run the government without Congress, and he just simply had to seize powers that were not granted to him under the Constitution. He had taken an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, the nation, and the people of the United States, and he intended doing just that. He had been commander-in-chief of the Continental Army for 8 years, a virtual dictator at that point. But as president, he seized powers and used them wisely and judiciously to preserve and protect the liberties, the individual liberties of the people, while at the same time preserving the Union. At his first act, actually, when the first Congress had adjourned in the fall of 1789, they had, unlike the present Congress, had passed a budget, but there was no money. There were no taxes at the time, and the kitty had run dry. There was no money, and the Congress really had to shut down the government, if you can imagine Congress ever doing such a thing. So the government shut down, but Washington, unlike later presidents, was a man of action and knew how to steer the ship of state. He was not going to let the government shut down. He took the law into his own hands, went to private banks, and borrowed money from private banks to keep the government running. Similarly, in the spring, when Indians and American Indians then were considered foreign nations. So when one of those nations attacked settlers in the Ohio Territory, again, Congress was out of session. President Washington was not about to allow his fellow citizens to be slaughtered, and he drafted troops and sent them to war unconstitutionally. Only Congress has the right to do that. And he sent them to war, again, to defend his fellow citizens and defend the nation's frontiers. Now, he set precedents, of course, for later presidents, but unlike later presidents, he used the powers he seized wisely. When he sent troops to war, American lives were clearly at stake. It's questionable whether any lives were clearly at stake when President Nixon sent troops into Cambodia.
Really, you bring to light in your book, Mr. President, how much that framework had to be filled in. There was no foundation. There was kind of a generality. And as you said, as they were trying not to install a new king, or a tyrannical ruler, most of the power was actually not in the president's hand, but the vice president's hand.
The power was really, remember, the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." And the power really lay in the House of Representatives, which was the only government body directly elected by the people. The Senate was appointed, really. The senators were appointed by state legislators. So we, the people, the House of Representatives, had the most power. As James Madison, who helped write the Constitution and was a member of Congress at the time, said, the most of the power of the government does not rest in the executive body. The executive office is the weaker of the various branches of government. So the House of Representatives had the most power and was least able to get anything done because it represented, there were representatives from every area of the country. And the interests of Georgia, for example, did not match the interests of New Hampshire. So there were constant squabbles. And sadly, what Americans today don't realize, what they call a dysfunctional Congress, is the price of liberty, is the price of democracy. Welcome to democracy, folks. This is not dysfunction. This is exactly what the framers intended. And compromise between these various conflicting interests is very difficult to achieve.
I'm speaking with Harlow Giles Unger, the author of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. And it's quite astounding how much George Washington influenced the office of the president, and influenced it enough that many of those precedents that he established are still in effect today. And as you said, that's the dysfunctional Congress. Well, welcome to democracy, because that's the way it's made to work.
Exactly. And Washington really created the office of the presidency. The Constitution created a figurehead. Washington transformed it into what modern scholars call the imperial presidency. At the time, James Madison called it the monarchical presidency. Washington set up what I call in my book, Mr. President, Washington established what I call seven pillars of executive power, the power to appoint and fire members of his cabinet, the power over foreign affairs to sign treaties, some power over government finances, a lot of power over national defense. And one of the major powers that he established, this is not granted by the Constitution, the power to issue proclamations and executive orders. Now, executive orders have the force of law, and the president does not have the right to enact a law under the Constitution. That's why Congress is called the legislature. But over the years since Washington, the presidents have issued almost 14,000 executive orders and proclamations with the force of law. Congress has only passed 20,000 laws, and the president has, in effect, passed almost 14,000 laws. It's just, it's outrageous, and it's unconstitutional, yet it goes on. President Obama has issued almost 200 executive orders with the force of law. Washington issued 8. And now, again, the things he did, the powers he seized, he used them wisely in issuing the first proclamation, the Neutrality Proclamation, which kept us out of an Anglo-French war. That set a precedent for Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation that ended slavery. So other presidents have indeed used some of President Washington's powers wisely in sending troops to put down a tax rebellion in western Pennsylvania. Washington set the precedent for President Eisenhower to send troops into Little Rock, Arkansas to ensure the right of black children to go to school with white children. So some presidents have used these powers wisely. Others have used them recklessly. For President Bush, George W. Bush, and President Obama to issue secret executive orders to allow the government to spy on every American telephone call, that is, in my mind, reckless.
Well, why do you think most Americans today mistakenly believe that George Washington was given these presidential powers as the first president of the United States, when in fact he took them?
Well, they assumed that the powers he had as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, during those 8 years, they assumed those powers carried over into the presidency, and they didn't.
Well, do you feel that there was ever a point that he stepped beyond his limits? Because really, he did usurp the Constitution in establishing some of these presidential powers.
Absolutely. I don't think he did. I think he's the greatest president in the history of the United States. And I think every time, he never did anything for political reasons. He did things for the best interests of the nation and the American people and the Union, to keep the Union together. Other presidents have overstepped the bounds. But having said that, in the course of our history, each of the three branches of government has overstepped its constitutional bounds. The three branches have always engaged from the very first in a tug of war for power. And fortunately, although all three branches have abused their powers, have violated the Constitution time after time after time, fortunately, the two other branches are always there to pull back when one of the branches oversteps its constitutional bounds, and to pull it back into constitutional compliance. After all, even the Supreme Court has violated the Constitution and overstepped its bounds with the Dred Scott decision that essentially legalized slavery. President Lincoln pulled them back with the Emancipation Proclamation. Congress has passed, as I said, about 20,000 laws since the beginnings in 1789, but the Supreme Court has declared 200 of them unconstitutional, and the presidents have vetoed 2,500 of them, because sometimes for political reasons, but also because they felt they were unconstitutional. So there's always a pullback with the other two branches when one of them oversteps its constitutional bounds. Now, what has happened to the Constitution? Well, former Vice President Dick Cheney called the Constitution a quaint document, and in a sense he was right, because all three branches of government violate the Constitution every day. It's really the balance, the checks and balances of the three branches that keep the government into relative constitutional compliance.
Mr. President, George Washington and the Making the Nation's Highest Office, the newest book from Harlow Giles Unger, who is speaking with us on Cincinnati Edition here on 91.7 WVXU. You mentioned, Harlow, the seven pillars of presidential powers that were established by George Washington that you lay out in the book: power over foreign policy and executive appointments and military affairs, and you mentioned the presidential proclamations and executive orders. But there have been other contributions, I guess you could say, to the office that George Washington has left a lasting mark with. Among them, the annual State of the Union address. And this came because of that weakened position of the president early on. And it's wonderful in the book how you lay out how Washington comes to Congress, not the man in power, but kind of hat in hand. It's just amusing how that first State of the Union address came about.
Well, that's why I called my book Mr. President, because most people don't understand or know the origins of that title. Actually, there was a big debate in Congress what to call the presidency. Some suggestions included His Elective Highness. others, there were all sorts of pompous titles presented until James Madison reminded Congress that the Constitution prohibits titles for American government officials, and that the president must be addressed as any other citizen, Mr. So he was indeed addressed as Mr. President. That almost caused him, it did cause a mini crisis when he went into the Senate one day with a proposal for a new treaty with the Indians. And the presiding officer in the Senate, is, of course, the Vice President of the United States. But as presiding officer in the Senate, he is addressed as Mr. President because he is President of the Senate. Well, here comes President Washington into the Senate, faced with the obligation of addressing his own Vice President as Mr. President. And George Washington was not about to do that. He, in his own inimitable way, he solved the problem. He walked out and never again set foot in the Senate. From that point on, every president has addressed Congress, only a joint session of Congress, in the House of Representatives, where the presiding officer is addressed as Mr. Speaker. And only the President of the United States is addressed as Mr. President.
Wonderful stories in the book, Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, a book by Harlow Giles Unger, who I'm speaking with right now. Another of the presidents established by George Washington for the office of the president was touring the nation. You share the story of how Washington set out on a 29-day journey after that first Congress was in recess and went to Connecticut and Massachusetts and Maine and New Hampshire and visited farms along the way and really talked to the constituents he was serving.
Remember, until that time, kings and other national leaders never set foot out of their palaces for several reasons. Number one, they were afraid they'd be assassinated. But number two, they were considered there by an act of God. Here was the first elected president in the history of the world. And George Washington believed in this process. Now, there were no mass media at that time, and no cameras, no ways of taking pictures. The only picture of the president was a painted portrait, which hung in somebody's house. But the ordinary people who had voted for the president didn't know what he looked like. And he determined to let the people see and touch their president, to become that he was indeed Mr. President, a citizen like every other citizen of the United States, elected by them to run the government. So he did indeed tour the nation to meet the people and let them meet him. He believed in this process very deeply. Unfortunately, what people today don't realize is that although people of the United States united behind the president, he was the only person elected by all of the people. The nation was made up of all of these different, often conflicting interests, and that produced constant debate and constant arguing, constant non-functioning of the Congress of the United States. To this day, Americans don't seem to realize that we are a large nation of diverse and often conflicting interests. And when Congress agrees to disagree, Americans call it dysfunction. Well, it's only dysfunctional if Congress doesn't do what I want it to do, isn't it? When Congress does what I want it to do, it functions beautifully.
Yes, indeed.
Unfortunately, if Congress does what I want it to do, it may harm you or someone else in a different region with different economic and social interests. And this is the price of democracy. As Washington's Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, put it, if you want an efficient government, get a dictator.
I was also touched by how accomplished he was as an agriculturalist. There's a lot of talk about his love of Mount Vernon and working the 20,000 acres of land there. I'm really a man that was close to the earth. And this showed when he was on this tour after that first Congress, when he was talking to farmers and speaking to them about their crops and all, that he was almost as renowned as a farmer as he was as the leader of our nation.
He was one of the most brilliant and best educated men in America. He was self-educated, like Benjamin Franklin. He had studied over 3,000 volumes of history, economics, literature, and agricultural science. He became one of the world's leading agricultural scientists and wrote many learned articles anonymously so that people wouldn't think that the journals were publishing his articles simply because of his name. So he wrote anonymously, but he wrote these very learned articles. He had done many, many experiments on soil, fertilizing soil, different crops, which crops grow in what, in which type of soil. And he built Mount Vernon, this 20,000-acre plantation, into what we would call today an agro-industrial enterprise with a number of money-making crops. He had wheat growing there. Of course, he had tobacco. He had a fishery. He had a textile manufacturing plant. One of his crops was hemp, which for making cloth. He had a brick-making facility. He had a distillery. A grist mill. He was a great, great businessman. He, of course, grew wheat and sold it at first to millers, and then he said to himself, "Well, if I built my own mill, I could I could turn my own wheat into flour and then sell the flour at a much higher profit." So that's why he built a grist mill. He was a one of the wealthiest men in America. His enterprise at Mount Vernon was one of the largest enterprises, business enterprises in America. So when he became president, he had honed his executive skills as a military leader, a commander in the field of an army of 15,000 men. He took an army of 15,000, mostly farmers, and defeated the most powerful, best-equipped, best-trained army in the world, the British Army. So he was a great military leader, and, of course, he was a great CEO of his own huge enterprise at Mount Vernon. And listeners who have not been to Mount Vernon really should go to visit Mount Vernon, his home, to see what not only a beautiful home that he designed. He was a great architect. This great enterprise that he built there.
We only have a moment left, Harlow. I wanted to ask, as intimate as you are with George Washington and his life and times, what is the myth about George Washington you most, as a historian, wish people would get right?
Well, I think the idea that he had an easy time of it, that he just sailed through his presidency. He invented the presidency. He turned it into the powerful office it is today. As you say, I've written a lot about George Washington. This is my third book. I wrote one on his private life, one on his struggle to pass the Constitution, and now this one on his really the creation of the American presidency.
And it was not easy, and that you make it quite clear here in the book, Mr. President. It's just amazing the struggles he went through and the successes he had.
He was an amazing man and by far the greatest president in the history of this country.
Harlow Giles Unger, he's the author of Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, available where books are sold. You can learn more about Harlow and his work and George Washington and the book at WVXU.org. Thank you again for your time, Harlow, and thanks for bringing Mr. President to life.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on your show. It's always an honor to be on that show.